why don't you just start with that, and then we'll go into each one of these periods.
Sure. My first interest in the historical background of the plans for the university came about in 1973 to 74. This was the 125th anniversary of the University of Wisconsin. And at that time, a great deal of effort was being expended on writing a book about the accomplishments of the university and the people who had been involved in it. But there didn't seem to be any emphasis put on the buildings of the campus at that time. Jeff Dean, who was then the, and still is, the Historic Preservation Officer for Wisconsin, and I were discussing this and made a proposal to the Campus Planning Committee that to celebrate some of the buildings of the campus, we ought to create some historical recognition. And at that time, what would be better than placing a district on the National Register of Historic Places? This was presented to the Campus Planning Committee and to the Chancellor, who accepted our proposal. A small committee was put together, and we spent time developing the Bascom Hill Historic District. It was approved by the Campus Planning Committee, then by the Board of Regents, and eventually it went to the National Park Service and was entered on the National Register of Historic Places. That was sort of my first interest in the development of a campus plan for the University of Wisconsin. From there, we could go back and take a look and see how the campus did develop. First campus plan that we recognize would be dated either 1850 or 1851, depending upon what document one looks at. And this was the work of John Rague, and I'm not quite sure how his name is pronounced. It's R-A-G-U-E, of Milwaukee. There is a plan dated 1850, which I don't believe was from Rague's hand, but it bears his name, that shows what we now call Bascom Hall and four other buildings. It would be North and South Hall, and then marching down the hill from that, two other buildings that would be twins to those, comprising a campus of five buildings. However, a year later, a perspective drawing appeared in one of the publications of the university, which supposedly was also Rague's plan, which showed five buildings, but not arranged in the same way. What has happened, however, that three of the five buildings were built, North and South Hall first, and as John Rague planned them, and later, what was called the main building, later University Hall, and now Bascom Hall. This was designed by William Tinsley of Indianapolis. I have no idea how he was selected or who knew him or why he came here. But his design, however, is not as we see Bascom Hall today. It didn't have the wings on the north and the south, nor those that stretched to the west. There was a cupola like dome on the building, quite small, and the architecture of the building seemed to follow very much the design of the Philadelphia Exchange Building that was designed by William Strickland almost 50 or 60 years earlier. Strickland's building is well known, and students of the history of architecture in the United States that would be familiar with that. It had a semicircular portico out in front, but it did have the very small cupola on top. Sometime around 1890 or so, the semicircular portico was removed, and the classical temple front that one sees on Bascom today was added. This makes it look a great deal like the State House in Boston, a design of Charles Bulfinch. However, the dome that was on it then doesn't seem to fit. And that was taken care of by a fire that took place in the early part of this century. Dome was never replaced, but I will mention a little bit about proposals for a dome later on. this sort of became the first campus plan for the university, just showing three buildings, and as time went on, of course, other buildings were added. Some, such as the original Building for the Law School by Charles Frost of Chicago, who had done work at the World's Columbian Exposition of 1893 in Chicago. So he was quite a famous architect. And this was done in what one would call Richardsonian Romanesque architecture, as is Science Hall, which dates from around 1886, I believe. Also was the Romanesque, Richardsonian Romanesque type architecture. At the time that Science Hall was built, it was considered the ugliest building on campus. And today we look at it as one of the landmarks on the campus. It's representative of a period of architecture that we don't see much of in the Midwest. Perhaps the most significant development in campus planning for the university took place in 1906. At that time, the Board of Regents hired two very well-known architects to develop a campus plan. One wonders a little bit on how this happened. Correspondence, however, does exist that gives us very good clues on what happened. First, there was some doubts in the minds of some of the regents about the capabilities of J.T.W. Jennings, who was then the supervising architect for the university, on his ability to do some planning. So they wanted some consultations to make sure that what was going to go ahead would be proper. And there was a dormitory group under consideration at that time, which I don't think was built. Or if it was, I don't know what unit they had in mind. At that time, Edward Burge, who was the dean of the College of Letters and Sciences, was also serving on the Madison Library Board, and I think as chairman of it at that time. And they were planning a new library. They were very much taken by the library in Winona, Minnesota, who was designed by Warren Powers Laird. Mr. Laird was the dean of the School of Art and Architecture at the University of Pennsylvania. He was a native of Winona, which was probably why he was picked to do the library locally. But at the time that Madison was building, he wasn't interested in individual commissions. So they prevailed upon him to be a professional advisor for a competition for Madison Library. Now, I don't have any idea who the architects were that were in the competition. But presumably, through his meeting with Edward Burge, who, of course, was a friend of Charles Van Hise, then president of the university, Mr. Laird became known to the president. And in the course of their conversations, as is reported in a letter from Charles Van Hise to Mr. Laird, there ought to be some way of unifying and developing a comprehensive campus plan for the University of Wisconsin. Mr. Van Hise asked Mr. Laird for some suggestions of who might be good architects to this. Laird's reply named some of the best known names in architecture at that time, and he followed with a little statement to the effect that, of course, he might be willing to undertake this himself, along with Mr. Cray, who was a colleague of his at the University of Pennsylvania. Well, that was, of course, the perfect opening that Laird wanted, and he was retained first to review Jennings' plans for the dormitory group, and I don't have any record of what his comments were on that. And then this followed up with the proposal to the Board of Regents that Warren Powers Laird and Paul P. Cray be retained to do a comprehensive plan for the constructional development of the University of Wisconsin. These two were augmented by Arthur Peabody as the third member of what was called the Architectural Commission. Now, I think it's interesting to know a few things about these people. First, Paul Cray was born in France and was educated at the École des Beaux-Arts. But he came to the United States about 1903 at the invitation of Warren Powers Laird to be on the faculty of the University of Pennsylvania. Almost immediately, Paul Cray entered into some design competitions and was a winner of the competition for the Pan American Union Building in Washington, D.C., which I still feel is one of the handsomest buildings in our nation's capital. Later, he did buildings like the Detroit Institute of Fine Arts, all kinds of government buildings. He did the Folger Shakespeare Library in Washington. And he did campus plans for Brown University and the University of Texas at Austin. So he was a well-known designer even by the time he came to this country. He was retained by our government to do practically all of the major battle monuments in France for World War I. Warren Laird was a native of Winona, Minnesota, as I mentioned earlier. He's a graduate of Cornell University in architecture and then became a dean of the School of Art and Architecture, University of Pennsylvania. The third member of this group was Arthur Peabody, who was an architect educated at the University of Illinois and was in private practice for a while before coming to the University of Wisconsin to replace J.T.W. Jennings in 1905 as the supervising architect for the campus. He held that position until 1915 when he became state architect for Wisconsin. Now, the title supervising architect perhaps doesn't mean much to most people, but then and for many years, it was perhaps the most prestigious title that an architect in public service could have. The most important public service position in the United States was supervising architect of the Treasury, which in effect was the nation's architect. And so the same title was adopted by the university in presenting it first to J.T.W. Jennings and then to Arthur Peabody. So these three men constituted the body that would develop a plan for the University of Wisconsin. Now, because Cray was educated at the École des Beaux-Arts, he had a very classical background. And the plan that has been seen many, many times in all kinds of publications in the university is a perspective drawing looking up Lincoln Mall from the State Street area. And you see a series of classical buildings that march up the hill. A pencil sketch of this drawing was found in some of the documents in Philadelphia that was given to me if I could find a home for it, which I did, and it's now in the Elvium. It's paper is very fragile, and it's being sort of kept as a rare document. Well, the campus plan that was developed by these three men, primarily by Paul Cray, and as a matter of fact, as Cray is quoted as saying by one of his colleagues who was still alive when I started some interest in this, was Mr. Laird just put the frosting on the cake, and that the work had been done by Paul Cray himself. So Cray did the drawings, and there must have been 20 or so in the set of the plan, very few of which remain, and I don't even know where the original drawings are because we just have copies of some of them, plus a document of a number of pages that described everything that was going to be done here. The drawings are dated 1908, but the document is dated 1909, so one can pick either date, I suppose, for the date of the plan. It was presented to the Board of Regents formally in 1909, but it was never adopted. It was just sort of felt everybody liked it, so we'd go ahead with it. But there's no motion that adopted the plan. So what are some of the things in the plan? One is that Cray felt that the architecture already being exhibited by North and South Hall and by Bascom should be a key to what goes on. And this was sort of an Italian Renaissance feeling. So that this was one of the recommendations. The other was the location of buildings throughout the campus. And when one realizes that this was done at a time when the campus had maybe 4,000 students, and it was projected that the campus might grow to 10,000 students, it becomes a remarkable document that shows how easily it adapted to a growth of the campus. Now, obviously, like any plan, there have been numbers of changes that have taken place. The College of Engineering, the extent that we have today, no one believed would happen. A medical school of the magnitude that we have today wasn't in anybody's mind. The fact that you'd have a football stadium that would seat 77,000 spectators, nobody thought about that. And yet the planning for the major academic groups and the planning for where residence halls would be is pretty much as proposed in that plan. Many of the buildings that were constructed after that also followed the character that was described by Paul Cray. Paul Cray, in association, of course, with Warren Parris Laird and with the state architect Arthur Peabody, was responsible for the design of some 10 buildings on the campus. The Board of Regents entered into a contractual agreement with Cray and Laird that for a fee, they would design the initial design and select the site for the buildings. And then after that, it would be up to the state architect's office to produce the actual working drawings, the construction documents, and to supervise the construction. So when I say they did 10 buildings, is that they did the initial design, and from then on, Arthur Peabody carried it out. So depending upon where one seeks the information is who you find credited with the building. There are documents at the University of Pennsylvania which do show the 10 buildings quite clearly on who did them. I was very fortunate that when we first presented the Bascom Hill Historic District, that the Chancellor, Irving Shane, was interested in it. And as we developed further some of these studies, the Chancellor was very supportive of what we were doing and sent me to the University of Pennsylvania to spend a few days in the archives to see what I could find out. And this is some of what came out of it. Well, following the development of the Bascom Hill Historic District and this information that we gathered on the 1989 campus plan, we thought that the information ought to be put where it could be used and available to others. It was at that time that the Chancellor provided us with some funding to hire some students and authorized a sort of a study committee to assemble and put all the information we had in some usable form. And this came out in 1978 in a document that's called Perspectives of a University. It's not something that one reads like a history book. Instead, it's a place that you can find all kinds of facts on who the architects were, what departments occupied the buildings, and what important discoveries were made in the buildings, or what items of scholarship took place there. To get all this information, we actually canvassed every single department on the campus, and it was interesting to see how some were just so anxious to let everybody know just about everything and everybody that had any role in their department, whereas others would send you two or three typewritten pages and say, I guess that's all we know about us, and go from there. The plan that was developed by Laird and Cray, there were some wonderful perspective drawings. I already mentioned one, which is the major perspective drawing looking up Bascom Hill. There was another one that they called the Lester Mall. We know this is Henry Mall today. And at that time, Ag Hall was already built, so you see that standing at the top of the hill, and then you see a series of classical buildings going down the mall. And buildings such as Ag Engineering, Ag Journalism, and Agricultural Chemistry, which is biochemistry today, all are very much in the same feeling, And they're matched by the Wisconsin High School, or 425 Henry Mall, right across it. And a point was made in the plan that Wisconsin High and Agricultural Chemistry would be the buildings that created the entrance to the Lesser Mall or Henry Mall. And it's fortunate that the other buildings I mentioned, Ag Journalism and Ag Engineering, are very much in the same feeling and architecture and scale and color and texture and form. So that it's a comprehensive piece of planning. The other buildings, which came in genetics and the State Lab of Hygiene, have the scale, but they lack the color and texture that blends them in with the other buildings. Following the work of, I might have mentioned along with this, there were other drawings, and one was, what would Bascom look like if another dome were placed upon it? Now, by this time that this question was asked, the state capitol had burned, but they had saved the old dome from the state capitol. And the proposal was, what would it look like if the saved dome would put on it? Now, when I first show a slide of this perspective drawing that was done by Cray, I sort of hear snickers from the audience. Until I put on a slide of the United States Capitol, and you see that the same scale prevails as does in Washington. So that it wasn't fanciful, it is something that would follow very much the same proportions as we have on our nation's capital. It was never done, however, as I understand it, the material from the old Capitol Dome was melted and reused in World War I for munitions or something like that. I'm not positive about all that. That's just another story I've heard. There were also many other drawings that showed what the residence groups would look like, both from out in front, and if you're out on the lake, what would they look like? And it was a marvelous set of drawings, at least from the salvaged photographs that I've seen of them. Well, what are some of the later developments? Arthur Peabody, of course, maintained a strong interest in the campus development as a state architect, and was called upon frequently to consult with the university, because by the time he became state architect in 1915, the university didn't really have anybody that fulfilled the old role of the supervising architect, and he sort of continued in the role that he had had. And in 1927, he proposed a plan, mostly of the lower campus, that was to give a sort of a classical entrance to the campus. And you'll see a couple of buildings that were just about where the Memorial Library is today. They have towers rising up, and it sort of just doesn't look like it belongs with anything else, in my opinion. And where the Union is today, there would be a Union, but it looks a great deal like Vizcaya in Miami, rather than something that belongs on Lake Mendota. So perhaps it's good that that plan just remained as a drawing. In 1948, the University of Wisconsin Foundation published a booklet that was sort of to be the 100th anniversary of the university and embark on a big building program. And they had their plans for the lower campus, including auditorium buildings and museums of art and science. I don't know who actually did the design for these, but I must say they were very much in keeping with what we see today in things like the State Historical Society, the scale, the style, character. So it might have been a nice addition. I don't think anything from this ever actually materialized. In 1941, the State Planning Office was asked to participate in the developing of a campus plan for the university, and people from the university and from the state office were all involved in this. But this is not the kind of plan that warms me at all. It's very much a statistical, two-dimensional, flat kind of thing, and it doesn't show the artistic creation that a plan such as Cray's did, or even Ragoo's. It just sort of plots on pieces of paper where one building might be or another one, and how many students might be in this place or another. And that's all part of planning, I suppose, but it doesn't show imagination or any feeling for the aesthetics, I believe, of a campus. So I don't know whatever happened to this, but there are a lot of copies of this plan that are around today in a thin, red, hardbound book. It wasn't until after World War II that I think we began to see big changes take place on the campus. After all, the enrollment was soaring. New disciplines were coming into being, and existing disciplines were expanding at an unprecedented rate. The first major development, I believe, was the development of a series of buildings on the engineering campus. And while they had names like Engineering 1, 2, and 3 and so on, it really was just one big building that housed different engineering disciplines. And this was followed by what had been a big lack on the campus, and this was a large library for the campus. Memorial Library was built in about 1953. The history of the library on the campus was that the first library was in what we call Music Hall today. And that building was an assembly building, and the part that is now the Rennebaum Theater. And the western part of the building was where the library was. And it was two stories high, and it was this little balcony that went around with all the bookshelves for the second floor, and the first floor had the reading tables on it. It moved from there into the north wing of what's now the State Historical Society, and well, always was the State Historical Society. And the library remained there from about, that would have been about 1900 to 1953 when the Memorial Library was built. Of course, at that time, when the collections were sort of separated, an agreement was made where American history items stayed with the State Historical Society and other items went to the Memorial Library. The catalog in the Memorial Library today catalogs what's in the State Historical Society because that's where the American history is. Another interesting building that followed about that same period was the Camp Randall Shell. And this dates from about 1954 through 56 in there. And these are forms that had been used by the military in World War II to make hangar structures and were sort of resurrected, and the structure was built on the campus. From then on, it's hard to say what building came where, but there was a series of buildings that just were part of a big surge of new structures on the campus. Some of this, of course, was the state feeling we were far behind in what we should have been doing for university. There had been so little done in these years. And the other was the emergence of funding programs at the federal level. We found that the Department of Health, Education, and Welfare had all kinds of funding programs for particularly disciplines with graduate programs. And then the National Science Foundation got in the act. NASA was in it. National Institute of Health. And every one of these participated in some way or another in a series of buildings on the campus. The Humanities Building, which one hardly thinks is one would have federal funding in it, and yet parts of history were eligible for federal grants in there, so there's probably about $250,000 in that. That was from the Health, Education, and Welfare. A building such as chemistry had Health, Education, and Welfare, had the National Science Foundation, it even had some NASA money in it, so that every time you made a payment to anybody, you would have to report this to these various funding agencies on who got how much and what parts of the building this was for. And it was almost a nightmare because we weren't using computers at all of this at the time. It was all manually done. I'm glad that that was not one of my jobs. A building such as Computer Science was also heavily funded through National Science Foundation. The last National Science Foundation grant that I'm aware of that was given anywhere in the country went to our geology and geophysics building. It wasn't a large part of it, but it was part of it. Of course, the major part of that was the gift of Mr. Weeks, after whom the building is named. So we find buildings just running down the line of Van Vleck, Van Hise, Humanities, Computer Sciences, Geology, Educational Sciences, and Teacher Education, Chemistry, the addition to Chamberlain Hall, which houses Physics, Molecular Biology. All of these had major components of federal funding. Now, during this period of time, I hate to say that there wasn't any plan being followed, but pretty much this was coming so hard and fast, it was a matter of where can we place the building? And you'll see that a building like Van Vleck looks like it's sort of standing by itself off to one side of Bascom, and where's the mate that should be on the other side? So that you have some of these questions in your mind, was there really a campus plan? Well, there were in parts of it. Certainly in the lower campus, when the humanities and Elvium were developed, the university's planning office had ideas for the development of that block. And it was very interesting that the original concept was to be three little towers, one for history, one for music, and one for art, and then a separate building for the Art Center, or the Elvium, as we know it today. But when Harry Weiss was hired to do this work, and at that time, Mr. Weiss would probably be considered one of the 10 best-known architects in the United States, he thought that it would be much better if the building looked more a mate to the State Historical Society than a building of three little towers bumping all the way up along there. So if you stand back and look at it, you'll see that the cornice lines of the two buildings, the Historical Society and Humanities, are very much the same. You'll see that the color tone of the concrete matches very much the oolithic limestone of the Historical Society. You also look at the stone on the base of the building, and you can see the same colors that one finds in North and South Hall and Bascom. So there was a relationship that he had in mind at the time. But interestingly enough, he also made it a more intimate building. As you walk through the plaza on the second level, you'll almost feel like you're in a little European city street going by the music hall offices. I think it's a very engaging composition. That building represents a form of architecture that we don't see that much of, and it was given the name the New Brutalism at the time. And I think some people feel it's an appropriate name, and others feel it's a little cruel for some of the buildings of that period. Certainly by the time Vilas was built, it was a softer interpretation of the New Brutalism, if you want to keep using that term. I'm sure it'll be in the textbooks 20 years from now. A major change in the university came probably about 1956 or so, as the university began to realize that it was going to have to expand in directions that it hadn't ever thought of. And this was primarily to the south of University Avenue. Through a series of proposals that went through, eventually through the legislature, new boundaries were established for the university that took us south of University Avenue. At that time, the university's campus planning office did have the opportunity to look at the whole area and decide how some of the development could take place. And this would be a far more urban development than the rest of the campus. And that's really what's happened, because as you look at buildings such as Ed Science, chemistry, the additions to computer sciences, you'll see taller buildings rising up that certainly reflect the fact that you're building on in a denser part of the city and where land costs are higher. Along with this, of course, came a change in thought and also in regulation, I guess you might say, in that the state was taking a far greater fiscal interest in the building of facilities. So that things like building efficiency, and that's the ratio of building's gross area to the actual usable area, precluded having great entrance halls like Burge Hall has. If you walk into Burge Hall, you'll see this sort of grand foyer that's there. And at one time, that grand foyer saw other uses. There were dances that were held there. And you can still picture it when you walk in there, the way the stairs go up to a balcony and this big open space. So when we remodeled Burge Hall, we sort of tried very much to bring back the foyer, the entrance lobby to the grandness that it once had. And I think that was successful. But you can't do that when you're only allocated so many square feet per faculty member and so many square feet for the staff, and so much for a classroom, and all the way down the line you're working by formula. So you lose the opportunity to provide grandness that took place a century earlier. And perhaps in some ways it loses its fun too.
Let's talk a little bit. One of the other subjects we talked about on the phone the other day was the whole parking, the development of parking on campus over time. You mentioned a state person.
Yeah.
Well, that.
I guess parking is a dilemma that faces many campuses. And while Cray's plan of 1908 even showed transportation routes through the campus and where there might be room for some vehicles. Of course, in 1989, you didn't think that much about it. So our biggest concern took place as the new medical center was being built. We recognized there would be more visitors coming to the campus, be more people employed. How could they all be accommodated? And we did quite a comprehensive study of how many cars we'd have to park on campus, and we began to plot where parking ramps ought to be. Some of them are finally coming about, but this is 20 years after the fact. We were held to a relatively low figure for the number of cars that could be parked on campus, pretty much through state and also City of Madison requirements. They didn't think we should be building that much, and there are all kinds of reasons given, and some may have been legitimate and some not, but, well, look at all the cars it's going to put on the public streets. Be too much traffic around there. Well, not everybody gets out of work the same hour on a university campus, so I don't think that was as legitimate a claim as it was purported to be. So we were faced then with serious parking problems, and anybody who works on the campus knows that, and the students know it too. Today, of course, is a new parking ramp out at the medical center. There's a new one down here on the lower campus. There'll be parking adjacent to the business school. So some of these issues are now being addressed, but we were forced for a long time to have inadequate parking, even though we were aware of the situation. And one only has to talk with the people that live in the fringe areas around Madison and find out what parking on their streets was like, and you'll find that it was a very real problem. So we were not masters of our own fate. As a matter of fact, this is one of the things that has happened with campus planning and around here, is that at the time that Cray and Laird did their plan, the regents were the ones who really called the shots. And they hired people that they wanted. But today it's different. It's all handled through the Department of Administration and through processes whose purpose is to keep everything above board and straight. And it probably does. But sometimes you don't get the results that you always want. That it may not be the person that you want to work with. You may have had problems with them in the past. Or there may be people you've been very successful working with and you'd like to continue that relationship. But you aren't the one that writes the contracts or pays the bills today. So that we haven't always been the masters of our own fate.
Could you comment briefly on, if you know this, when that shift came from the regents to the legislature?
You know, could we break for a minute?
Sure.
Okay. Do you have a men's room handy?
Oh, sure do. Start with the humanities.
Well, one of the first buildings that I got really deeply involved with when I arrived on the campus in 1965 was the Humanities Building. Initially planned to be three towers, as I mentioned, plus the Elvium, it developed into this single large structure with some relationship to the State Historical Society and the walkways going through the building. At the time it was programmed, it was felt that the campus here would grow to about 32,000 students. And everybody thought that that was very optimistic. So that the amount of space that was programmed for each one of the disciplines in the building, that is history, art, music, and then art history in the Elvium, would be based upon their share of the 32,000 students. Well, so what's happened? We've passed 32,000 students a long time ago, and some of these disciplines have grown. So that there's a crowding that has taken place in offices, in classroom space, and in some of the lab type space. In addition, there have been several other programs that have been sort of shoehorned in the building too. Art at that time was considered very much of a undergraduate program, and that there was very little of a graduate level instruction that would be taken on in art. It's sort of flip-flopped now, and graduate instruction, which always takes more space, is the major element of the program. Consequently, there's more tightness in the art program than was ever visualized. It makes it very difficult for these three disciplines to all feel comfortable there. As a matter of fact, art is sort of scattered all around in other places, in addition to their share of the Humanities Building. It was during this period of time and the development of the Humanities Building that I had a chance to meet a man that had a great influence upon the building programs of the university, and that was Kurt Wendt, who was then Dean of the College of Engineering. During the development of the Humanities Building, it was quite interesting to me that Robin Fleming, who was the chancellor at that time, and Kurt Wendt were both so closely interested in everything that went on dealing with buildings. I remember many times when one or the other would drop in our little office, which was then at 811 State Street, and say, I've got something I want to talk to you about. Come on out to lunch with me. And it could have been Don Seitz, who was then university architect, or me, or Jim Edsel, who was the director of the department, would share our feelings about some of the building program at that time. Kurt was a supreme diplomat. He chaired the campus planning committee as the appointee of the chancellor. Our bylaws, or whatever one calls them, delegates the chairmanship of that to the chancellor, who, of course, sometimes attends and most of the time doesn't. And Kurt was the designee of several chancellors to serve as the chair of that committee. Kurt had the uncanny ability to be able to see what the campus as a whole needed, not just what his own college needed. And he could balance the needs of one college versus another and get the whole campus planning committee to agree almost with unanimity on what the direction of the program ought to be year after year. Kurt was a real pleasure to work with, and I value the many years that we worked together. I would also say of the other people I've worked with on the campus, Irving Shane is the other one that I felt had a strong interest in what went on. I mentioned his support of our historical studies on the campus, and he would always, sort of when we met, have a question about a building that was going up or what was being planned, indicating to me that he was very much abreast of what the campus planning developments would be. I was very much taken when he called up one day and he said to me, I know you're interested in preservation activities. What would it take to make a good auditorium out of Music Hall? He says, call me back tomorrow. So I really thought about it and the things that we would need, and that was the start of the Carol Rennebaum Theater. He already knew who he was going to approach for funding on this, and I think he had a pretty good idea of how much money he could get and what he wanted to see come out of it. So that it was then that I learned of his interest in music, which I hadn't known about before. Another big, huge project, I guess, is in fact the time it was undertaken. It was the largest construction contract that the state had entered into, and this was the medical center. Even before I came on the campus, there were all kinds of studies being done to figure out how they could make the old medical center on University Avenue continue to grow. One looks and sees the cancer research building, McArdle, standing up there by itself, and many people say that no wonder it's a cancer research building, it looks like a cancer. That was meant to be one out of three identical towers that would have been in the area, would have housed other medical type activities. But about 1964, thereabouts, a consulting firm in Minneapolis was hired to come down and do a curriculum study of what the medical center would need to house an updated, modern teaching hospital complex. And when they came back with their results, we and they thought it appropriate, we would see if it could fit on the site. Well, we came up with a model that just looked like the Chrysler Building and Empire State Building and Sears Tower, and all of those are all plumped down on University Avenue, and we just shook our heads and said it can't be. So shortly afterwards, a firm from Sausalito, California was hired, who had been involved in a lot of medical center planning, to come up and take a look at a couple of sites around, and one of them, of course, is the West Campus site where the medical center is today, and to see whether it would accommodate what we had in mind for a medical center, or this earlier portage show we needed for a medical center. Well, they came back with little study models of the site that reminded one, or at least reminded me a lot, of the National Institute of Health Centers in Bethesda, Washington, which is a series of individual buildings, much like a campus of its own, and in this case connected underground with tunnels where stretchers could be wheeled around and so on. And it was a very interesting looking campus plan for a medical center. It did show that the facilities that were needed for our university's medical center would fit on that site. So that was sort of the go-ahead sign to start moving. And it meant working with the legislature to get support for a new medical center, working with federal granting agencies to see what kind of funding would be available to go toward a new medical center. And the project got started in its planning stage. As it was developing, and it looked like that this was going to be on the order of $120, $130 million for a medical center at that time, the governor said, no way. $80 million is the top. I just remember hearing that. I wasn't at the meeting, but that all came back to me. And so we said, well, how does one handle that? Well, the answer at that time was that the basic sciences or those courses taught in the first 2 years of medical education would remain at the old site, and we would remodel the old medical center to accommodate those programs during the first 2 years of medical education, plus some certain research-type programs that could take place there. And all the clinical studies and hospital facilities would be out at the West Campus. So that way, the initial phase was within the limits set by the governor. As you can see, as time has gone on, more and more has developed out there. As the medical center has grown, as new disciplines and new techniques have evolved, and they probably will continue to grow. We already see that a lot of the clinics are moving out of that section over toward the railroad station complex on University Avenue. And that's probably working very well because it also distributes some of the parking, so it's not all in one place. And I suppose with the amount of research that's going on, it's going to be necessary to keep using the space at 1300 University Avenue as well as the medical center. Another school that's had growing pains for a long time has been the School of Business. Of course, when their building was first built up there, the Commerce Building, everyone thought that that would last forever, of course. But business has been one of the faster-growing disciplines on the campus, and that building is way undersized for what the School of Business needed. As a matter of fact, all of their library facilities and a few other collateral activities have been in parts of Bascom Hall. And the library is just sort of shoehorned in there to work. We thought it was a wonderful solution when we proposed it, but they've long since outgrown it. Thus, the need for a large new complex for the School of Business has resulted in the building that's now under construction on University Avenue. As one ponders where the university will be going in the future, I think there's some things that we have to recognize and perhaps use to our advantage. And one is that we do have a lot of older buildings, and a lot of older buildings with some unusually good or important character to them, one might say. We already showed when we took King Hall some years ago and remodeled the old King Hall into a modern soils laboratory building for the school. And granted, there were problems. It isn't like building a new building where you can do everything just the way you want it. But the people have been proud to be occupants of that remodeled building. So I think we're going to see that we have to keep looking very closely at our older buildings on how we can make best use of them. There are state laws now that mandate historical inventories of state facilities. And the university, as well as DNR and Health and Social Services, anybody else, is going to be charged with doing this work. I think that our publication back in 1978 of Perspectives of the University was perhaps a very forward step that, in a way, anticipated by close to 20 years what the state legislation and I was talking about. But we'll have to start thinking about which of our buildings can be adapted to good contemporary uses without jeopardizing the academic functions that'll have to be in there and retaining the historical character of the buildings. Keeping a medical center up to date is always going to be a important goal of any major teaching institution such as ours. And we will see changes and additions and expansions through the years. And we hear more and more about shorter hospital stays, but then more people are availing themselves of medical facilities today. So that a lot of our work in the medical center is going to be revising, changing to meet the growing needs of the new techniques that have become available in medicine. One only has to listen to your Eye on Health on TV or anything to see about the new techniques that are becoming available. And every one of them that does either requires a new piece of equipment or a different space or more people or something, so that that will be a continuing problem. One of the things that we always had before us was the fact that it took so long to build a building. From the time we first met with the faculty to the time we started putting out the statistics together to justify to the legislature, by the time it went through the legislature and the various types of planning analyses that have to take place, it seemed like it was 8 to 10 years from the time a building was thought of till the time somebody moved in to use it. Consequently, we would always be chastised for having an obsolete building by the time somebody wanted to move in it. But our answer was that we aren't doing the university as a whole isn't doing its job if the building isn't obsolete by the time they move into it. They should be advancing faster than we can build them. Other changes that the university might see are, for me, hard to predict, because in the 20 years that I was there, I saw changes all the time that I never imagined would take place. We can certainly see that engineering emphasis changes continually, where some of the disciplines such as metallurgical and civil that at one time were the big bulwark of an engineering school are just a smaller number of a great big complex of many other engineering disciplines. I hope that we don't lose sight of the fact that we should be always conscious of the visual impact that our buildings present on the campus. And I don't think that I could ever say it as well as Paul Cray did in his 1909 campus plan. And it's a statement that Chancellor Shane used one time in one of the annual reports that was published, because I guess that we had a chance to talk about some of these things off and on. But Paul Cray said this: a final and most important consideration should be noted as to the value in the life of the student of the beauty and nobility of environment. No doubt can be entertained upon this point, the refining and uplifting influence of good architecture, though silent, is no less potent in the cultivation of the student than other forces more consciously exerted to that end.
Well, Ralph, if you can think of a better way to end it than that, I will pin a medal on you.
That's just fine. Thank you so much.
Very great. That was good.
I've always liked that statement.
That's a really nice quote. Yeah. And it's really nice to have that coming from one of the real distinguished people in the history of this whole thing.
Yeah.
Just one other thing before they take the tape off up there. You can leave it off for now. But are there any, Art has told us some
the campus planning committee then.
Okay.
The way the planning process works on the campus is that there is a campus planning committee whose membership is sort of set up by some university regulation that stipulates the number of deans that have to be on it and the representatives of a biological group and a humanities group and this sort of thing. So that there is a pretty good mix, and you'll find that there are several people who are voted upon by the faculty as faculty, general faculty representatives on the Campus Planning Commission. And it's the chore of this group to, perhaps one thing, come up with a proposed building program each biennium. And this is, they have to think 6 years ahead, so they're doing it for the immediate biennium and then the two beyond that. Well, it's very interesting to sit there and watch the politics going on in this, how, well, you know, engineering got one last time, so we ought to give one to agriculture, and this going back and forth, and then somebody coming up and saying, well, yes, but we'll lose out on a grant if we don't get this thing through. So that there's a lot of wheeling and dealing going on at times on this, and it means that some elements sort of seem to keep coming up biennium after biennium, and nobody supports them. Who is there that's going to get up and promote something for dance? I mean, it's a program that's very small on the campus, and it's been here for quite a while. So it's kind of interesting when you all of a sudden you see people coming in, and they've got a slideshow on dance. And all of a sudden, the campus planning people sort of sit back and look, you know, oh, we've never thought about that before. I guess they do need a theater. So you see some of this coming through, and you watch how the different colleges then come back the next time and try and put on a better slideshow than the last one put on why they need this kind of building. And I remember one time when the late Bob Ratner got up and he had taken slides of every kind of place in the College of Engineering that looked like a rat trap. And I know not all of the College of Engineering looks like that, but when you saw that show, you thought that there wasn't a place in that college that was good for anything. So that comment comes up from one of the members, and I don't know who it was, and said, well, if that's the kind of school it is, I don't think I'd ever want my child to go there. And then there's this, all this apologies. Well, we do have some good laboratories there. And but we started a policy of trying to have some members of the campus planning committee visit the facilities that the other members were complaining about. And this was all kind of interesting because sometimes they'd have a hard time finding the real dismal facilities that they were telling everybody existed. But then I remember one time we went down the engineering research building into the section where there was some kind of a nuclear accelerator, and it was so crowded, and this wasn't put on. This was the way it was. And you thought, I don't even want to go in there. I might get, you know, a jolt here or there. It's just so crowded with all this high voltage all over the place. So that was a new experience for some of the members of the Campus Planning Committee. I think it was a good one because oftentimes they who are making decisions don't really see what the rest of the campus is like. I know as staff, I had the opportunity to go in just about every hole, even climbing down in the utility tunnels on the campus, when we felt that these were things that should be brought before them. I think one point that I didn't make about Paul Cray when I talked about him. Paul Cray was one of the few architects in the United States that was ever received the gold medal of the American Institute of Architects. Other architects who have received that, of course, have been Frank Lloyd Wright and Louis Sullivan. But Cray is the only one who has designed a building on our campus of that stature. And I think it's a tribute to the Board of Regents at that time that they would hire somebody who was well-known at that time, but who would go on to be one of the finest architects that is practiced in this country. I think we tend to ignore people like that here because, generally speaking, the Midwest is not that attuned to classical architecture. The classical revival took place about the turn of the century, and it's only buildings like the State Historical Society that we see really great examples of it. Then we can look at some of Paul Cray's works on the campus, Lathrop Hall and Barnard, the Home Economics Building, Wisconsin High School, even the old University Avenue heating plant, which is patterned after a classical Roman basilica. So that some magnificent architecture grew out of his association with the University of Wisconsin. And I think we should try and save all of it.
Well, that's two times we've ended, and both times we've ended on Cray. And this time I'm going to say, let's cut this. That's very good. I'm glad we got that little bit in there, Ralph, at the end. That was nice. We have a little business in.